So we started previously, we went through two courses going through, I guess, like a thumbnail sketch of all of Jewish history, trying to cover the basics from the Torah to all the way into modernity, touching upon some of the movements in modernity. What I want to shift to tonight is, I think, a lot more as if Jewish history isn't a complicated topic with controversy and all kinds of things in that. I want to move to a topic that is very tricky. And I'm excited to talk about it because of the trickiness that's involved. And the topic tonight is going to be, what do Jews believe? I chose the title from Hermann Wouk's book, This Is My God. It's a book that I've started. I haven't finished. Everybody recommends it to me to read, but definitely as a title, it's really good. We're going to focus in on the 13 principles of faith as enumerated by Maimonides. But before that, let's go back for a second. Why is this such a tricky topic? The trickiness of the topic lies, I think, in two things. The first is that you'll hear often that people say that Judaism is a religion that's focused primarily, it gives primacy to action. It gives primacy to the things that we do and not necessarily the things that we have in our heart, right? God is interested in our mitzvot. God is interested in our good deeds, and God necessarily is less interested, as this argument would go, less interested in what exactly is in our hearts. Forget what's in your hearts, it's what you do. And that Judaism is an action-oriented religion. That's fair enough. That's one perspective of it. I think that this is something that comes up from time to time. There was a gentleman a number of years ago. I think his name was like David Lefkowitz or something like that. He published an article in one of these magazines. I think it was Commentary or I forget. One of these like one of these repositories of Jewish thought and essays. And essentially, he coined the term. I think he was the one that coined it. Orthopraxy. Orthopraxy means like this: I don't really believe in anything, right? He basically writes an article that he's long since given up belief in God. He's functionally an atheist. I don't remember the details of it, but especially on belief in the eighth principle of faith, in the divinity of the Torah, the fact that our Torah is a Torah that came from God. He basically said, "I've given up on all these things. I've read enough academic works. I've been enough places that these concepts as articles of faith are essentially meaningless to me. I don't believe in these things anymore." So he says, "And yet I still lead a fully Orthodox observant lifestyle. I go to synagogue every Sabbath." I think he even went to daily minyan at the time in the article. He went to daily prayers. He was talking about participating. He goes through a regular Sabbath with full observance of the Sabbath and the laws of kashrut, meaning in practice, he was keeping all the mitzvot, but at least in the sense of his beliefs, the stuff that he was thinking about, the stuff they believe, he did not believe in any of this. How is that possible? So it's possible if we orient ourselves to a Judaism that is a Judaism that is fully one of action and having nothing to do with our beliefs. But the question of must a Jew believe in anything is, I think, one that should be explored. I think it's my contention, and I'll say this, I've thought about this a lot, and the place that I come out to before we go into the details of this is, I think, the following. I think that it's incumbent upon every Jew to try and believe. I think that we have to. I think that it's not a zero sum game, that you believe and you don't believe, and there's no gray in between. Like everything else in life, as you grow up, you realize that there are a million different gradations of where you lie on the spectrum of believing, practicing Jew. There's this like online web series. I think the comedian was this comedian Zach Galifianakis was his name, and he would interview celebrities, and it would be like he would try and put them in like these surreal situations. So he interviewed Paul Rudd, who I believe is a Jew, and he said to Paul Rudd in it, he said, "I hear you're a practicing Jew." And right, Between Two Ferns is the name of it. Thank you. So Paul Rudd says, "I'm not a practicing Jew. I've perfected it." Right. So that's that was the line. And we all lay somewhere on the realm of practice, and no area I think requires more practice than the area of belief. Because another rabbi that I really really love, Rabbi Menachem Froman, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, may the memory of the righteous be for a blessing. He wrote that, like a lover plucking off the petals of a flower. She loves me. She loves me not. She loves me. She loves me not. He says that that's his relationship with God. Yesh ayin, meaning there is, there isn't. Yesh ayin, there is, there isn't. That the process of faith, the process of belief, is one that's dynamic. Some days we believe more than others, and some days we're sure as we can be that there's, that this is the capital T truth, and that there's nothing else but God. And some days we feel like it is empty and meaningless and nothing, and we're here and we're gone and we'll be forgotten. I don't know. I could go deeper and deeper into the pit of despair over here, but essentially that none of this is true. Our faith lies somewhere on this spectrum. So I want to talk about what it might be, but I'll end on this point. Where I land on this particular issue is in the following way. I think that if you were to press me on it, I would say that you should be trying, you should be practicing these ideas and thinking about them. They're certainly as articulated by Maimonides, which is the most potent and cogent presentation of Jewish dogma, as it were. At the end of the day, I think that if you look at it in a negative way, the via negativa, if somebody were to come to you and say, as a Jew, do you accept that there could be more than one God? Or do you accept that the Torah can be abrogated? Or do you accept that Moses was not the greatest prophet? That even if you're not a place where you fully believe that Moses was the greatest prophet intellectually, or that the Torah is absolutely divine, and that you're still learning about understanding, you would deny the possibility that this would be false. Meaning that you accept these things enough to reject the possibility that other things would be true instead. I hope that that's clear. That's where I land on that. That if somebody were to come and tell me, I'm not 100% certain, let's say, I'm not 100% certain about the incorporeality of God, that God has no body. Let's say I'm on the process. If somebody says to you, God must be corporeal. So I could certainly say as a Jew that is not true, that is impossible, that cannot be true. I'm on the process of getting myself to a place of understanding what it means that God is beyond body and physicality, but I certainly would reject anything that negates these principles. That's where I land on this particular thing. So let's get into it. We're gonna try to cover as many of the bases as possible. Again, none of this is meant to be exhaustive. None of this is meant to cover all the bases. There is a wealth of literature on these topics. Maimonides, just to back up for a second, Maimonides is considered, since the Talmud, since the closing of the Talmud, the greatest, I think. It's fair to say the greatest rabbi of history. He was a rabbi, he was a philosopher, he was a physician, he was an exile of Spain. He was brilliant in every way. He summarized the entire Torah. He was a philosopher of note, even in secular philosophy. Maimonides is quoted. He's called the Great Eagle, actually, in rabbinic writing, the Nesher HaGadol, because of his significance and his importance. There are whole libraries that could be filled with commentaries on the Rambam, on Maimonides. The Rambam stands, it's an acronym for Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Moses ben Maimon, or Maimonides for short. And in his introduction to the Mishnah, so there is the introduction to, which is the chief work of the Oral Torah. There is a chapter in Tractate Sanhedrin, which starts off with the lines, Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. Every Jewish person has a portion in the world to come, except the Mishnah goes on to elucidate some of the people who forfeit their portion in the world to come. And the reason that they forfeit their portion of the world to come is the Mishnah lists certain beliefs or certain opinions that put somebody so far beyond the pale that they have therefore forfeited their portion of the world to come. The Rambam, in his introduction to this chapter, outlines 13 principles of faith. Now, I should say that it's not that this has been fully accepted and understood for all of... Thank you. It's not that this has been fully accepted and understood as everybody to be, you know, concrete, that this is what you must believe. This is something that the Rambam formulated, but it became iconic. If you've ever heard the Yigdal prayer, you guys know the Yigdal prayer that they say, Yigdal Elohim Chai V'yishtabach. I should finish that line. Right there, that whole Yigdal is a poem based on these 13 principles. If you're looking at the Siddur, you'll see the translation of Yigdal, and you'll see that it covers all of these bases. Or you might be familiar with songs, Ani Ma'amin, I believe, or Ani Ma'amin, I believe. All these belief statements, these credo statements, come from Maimonides' 13 principles. There were people who rejected a number of these principles outright and said, you know, you can't really say such a thing. But Maimonides was adamant that these are the principles of faith. And essentially, one who doesn't believe any one of these principles has forfeited their portion in the world to come. Again, with the caveat that I said, you know, what does full belief mean? That's a really hard thing to talk about. But let's go through all of them as a list, and then we're going to do them individually. The first belief, the Rambam says, and this is my own paraphrase of each of these. Can you guys see the screen? Just give me a thumbs up if you can see it. Excellent. The first belief, Maimonides says, is that there is a creator. Our world is created. Our world had a, if you want to use philosophical language, the primary mover, the first mover. There is a creator, right? Hashem created the world. And we're going to call God, from now on, we're going to say Hashem instead of God. Hashem means in Hebrew, the name. And the reason we say Hashem is because God does not reveal himself to us through picture, through images, through anything that we could sense, touch, taste, feel, see. We can feel the presence, but that's metaphysical feeling. Hashem, the only way that God truly reveals himself to us since the giving of the Torah and since miracles is through the divine name. There are many divine names, but through the name. The most important of the names being Yud, Ke, Vav, Ke. Yud, and then the letter He, and then the letter Vav, and then the letter He. The amount of reverence that Jewish people have for God's name, that tetragrammaton, that four-letter name, is so immense that it is it's not allowed to be read. You cannot read the name as it is written. We say something else. It's an amazing thing. Kids at the very youngest age, kids in our first grade or even earlier when they start to learn their blessings or their prayers, they know that when they read everything else, they say what's on the page. But when it comes to God's name, you can't say it. That's how we, I always get the heebie-jeebies. Sometimes you see certain types of like evangelical groups or other groups that actually pronounce the name and you're just like, whoa, every time you see it, you're so conditioned, like, hey, you can't do that. But I guess for them, it's okay. They're not, they might be commanded actually on this as one of the seven Noahide commandments to not pronounce the name as a subcategory of them, but that's a separate topic. Anyway, so I'm using the word Hashem. It's more intimate. It's the name. It's the name of God that I feel is closer to us and more references what we know of God, the revelation of God through his name, the name. So the second principle is that Hashem is one. I put one over here almost in scare quotes because one is a number that is a quantity more than zero and a quantity less than two. It's an integer. When we talk about oneness over here, what Maimonides says in philosophical language that we'll see is that one over here means complete unity, right? Complete unalloyed unity, nothing else, no admixture, nothing else brought into it. It's a one without a two, without a zero. It's just complete totalizing unity. So we use the number one to illustrate that, but all of this, especially in the first two principles, are things that lie just beyond the ken of our comprehension, just beyond what we can fully understand. Number three is that Hashem is not physical. Now, this is one that I told you, I'm just going to stop sharing so I could speak freely a little bit, that Hashem is not physical. This one caused a lot of problems for people. The Ravid, who wrote a super commentary, the Ravid is Rabbi Abraham ben David of Poskiers, I think his name of his town, was a contemporary of Maimonides. He wrote a super commentary to Maimonides. The Ravid took major issue with this particular principle. He said, Rambam, there were many, many great people who came before us that believed to a certain extent that God did have some degree of physicality. There was a Kabbalistic book, for example, called Shi'ur Koma, which gave, you know, these massive cosmic dimensions to a way in which God manifests, you know, 300 galaxies wide and, you know, these many galaxies long. He says, you're going to condemn these people to hell. You're going to say that these people have no portion in the world to come. Where do you get off saying such a thing, Rambam? He's not disagreeing, by the way, per se, that the Rambam is correct in that God does not have any corporeality, but saying that this is an absolute article of faith that people must believe in, that's beyond the pale for him. Nevertheless, you would be easily misled, because if you read our Torah, you would find out in our Torah that there are many verses in the Torah that seem to ascribe some anthropomorphic qualities to God. One of them, for example, we see that God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, Biyad Chazaka Ubizroa Netuya, with a strong outstretched arm. I don't understand. If God is incorporeal, how could God have a hand or an arm? Or God is described as looking at the land of Israel later on in Deuteronomy as Einei Hashem Elokecha ba mireishis hashana ad achris hashana. The eyes of God are on the land of Israel from the beginning of the year to the end of it. God doesn't have eyes. So how can we ascribe something like that to God? So already by the third principle, right, we start to run into problems. But suffice it to say that if we were to believe that God is physical, and this is something to really struggle with, because, you know, I was having a conversation with our eighth graders, and the conversation turned to God, and I said, you know, when it is like an exercise to do with them, I said, when I say the word God, or Hashem a little bit less, but when I say the word God, what comes to mind? And, you know, you come to the understanding that when you say God, what comes to mind is essentially an old man with a white beard. You know, it's never a woman for whatever reason, right? There's no reason it shouldn't be, right? So he's an old man with a white beard. I said, you know, I saw a movie. I forgot the name of it, with Jim Carrey. God is Morgan Freeman, right? God is, I forgot what movie it is. God is Morgan Freeman, right? It's an image. It's a physical image that's in your brain. God is completely incorporeal. God has no body. God is beyond physicality. God engenders all physical things, but is beyond physicality. So that's the third. That's the third of the... That's the third of the beliefs. The next one is that Hashem is eternal. Hashem is, was, and always will be. This is revealed to us in the very name of God. The Yud, and then the Hey, and then the Vav, and then the Hey. Actually, if you really to cogitate on this, to think about this, it contains all the tenses in Hebrew. Past, present, and future are contained within one word. It's a very mind-blowing concept, right? If you're familiar enough with Hebrew grammar, or even if you're not, right, when I say something yeh, right, usually that means something will be. Hoveh, the word hoveh means the present. And then a vav hey, a hey at the end of the word usually means a past. So it's this magical word that somehow contains past, present, and future tenses all within the same word. I mean, that's how awesome this concept is, that God lies beyond all things, that God is, really blow your mind, God is in all times. God is in all places at all times, and God is at all times in all places. God is eternal. And after, and we say in Adon Olam, I like that we sneak this in at the end of Tefillah. We say in the end of Adon Olam, Acharei kichlos hakol liv ado yimloch nara. After the great heat death of the universe, after everything fizzles out, many billions of years, it will only be God, just as it was only God before everything was created. And in the middle, it was only God also. There's a rather difficult line in the prophets that says, Ani Hashem lo shinisi. I am God, I do not change. And the Kabbalists struggle with this notion that if God is so rarefied and so above, that God is even unchanged, ready for this? God is unchanged by the very act of creation itself. Right? This interlude between the creation of the universe and the end of the universe, right? That interlude of us, that also doesn't affect God at some place, right? The great miracle is, right, the great mystery is that God somehow decided to create our world and to interact with us and to give us a Torah and for us to wrangle with these things as infinitesimal human beings. That's really something for another time. We could talk about that in other philosophical issues another time. Number five is that there should be no other gods but Hashem. Hashem and only Hashem. Even though that the Torah sometimes uses the words Elokim Achirim, or when the Torah commands us on idolatry, it says, Lo yalecha Elokim Achirim apanai, thou shalt not have other gods in front of me, right? And it makes reference, uses words that seem to refer to other deities or other powers. The Torah's project is to move us away, to move human beings away from a multiplicity of deities and to introduce the concept of monotheism, ethical monotheism, as it were. You cannot have any other gods. It's only God, God and only God. Any other belief in another power or a trinity of powers or a division of powers, or even if you believe that God is divided into 10 different powers that act independently of one another, right? All of that would be akin to idolatry. That would be akin to something that would be against that second principle, against the unity, the absolute unalloyed unity of God, and certainly would limit on having any other gods. You can't have any other gods. We have, you know, statements from the rabbis that said that the tractate on idolatry that Abraham had, Abraham, the first iconoclast, the one who shattered all the idols, that had 400 chapters. The chapter, I think, on idolatry in our Talmud is something like 7 chapters. And what that's meant to say is that the path that Abraham, that first Jew, the path that he blazed for us as Jews was to move us ever so far away from the concept that there could be anything, anything other than God and God alone. So let's continue. So that is, now we're starting to, as you notice, and I'm going to talk about this in a moment, this is a progression. Number six is the concept of prophecy, that this God, this creator who's total unity, this creator who is beyond physicality, this creator who is eternal, and that there's nothing but this creator, number six is wild. Number six says, looks like we might have to do this in two different shiurim, I'm starting to see. I hope that that's okay with you guys. It's looking like we're doubling every class in the series. Bit off more than we could chew. And I'm trying to move slowly. I'm slowing myself down. Take a deep breath. I'm forgetting that I'm sick also, which is really, really nice. Just going to take a little bit of tea. Number six. Hashem, this God of all these things, this God chooses to communicate with us, communicates with humanity. I put over here prophecy, which is the real language that's used in the Ikar, in this principle itself. I like the language God communicates with us because that refers to our own times. When I say that God communicates with us, it means that even though prophecy ceased with the destruction of the temple, that we still have a way of communicating with God nowadays. Prophecy ceased, but we could feel the Spirit move us. Right, we could feel what's called Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. You know, even small people like me could have moments that we feel are transcendent, that the universe is speaking to us. I remember a year or two after my grandfather passed away, I keep like these small notebooks. I'll show you like kind of like what I have inside. And you know, any like Torah thought or idea that comes to me, so I like to write down in these notebooks. And I, you know, I like to fill it up. And I usually write, you know, this one is particularly, I ended up like going across the pages. I don't know if you can see, right? And shout out to Baron Fig notebooks. I like these dot grid notebooks. I should get sponsors. But I felt, I don't know what, it was very late at night and I was learning Torah and I was in like a really good place. And I felt like my grandfather's hand was writing through me. I don't know how to explain the feeling I had. As I was writing on the page, my handwriting started to change. I was I was in this like flow state and write that, you know, grab the idea before you forget it. And it's the greatest idea ever and total novel concept. And I felt my grandfather's handwriting through me. To me, that's a divine moment on my very own small level that may have been induced by, you know, complete lack of sleep. I think we had like a newborn at the time and stress from work, all kinds of stuff like that. But there are moments where the word I love for this is a term that Professor Michael Fishbane, used to be head of Jewish Studies Department at the University of Chicago, great writer. He writes, do I have the book on the shelf over here? I should have it over here. I don't see it. He writes, he calls this a caesural moment, caesura, right? Like from cesarean section. A moment where our reality, our physical reality is kind of torn open, torn asunder, and we feel the presence of God. Even that is God communicating with us. But the Torah and Tanakh is a record of God's communication. This infinite, completely unified creator, the only creator, there's nothing else, chooses to communicate with us, finite human beings. That's prophecy. Prophecy is that information comes down to us with content, with form, with instructions sometimes. I always like to talk about the fact that Moshe, the greatest prophet, which is principle number seven, the greatest of all prophets, Moses' prophecy is not these cosmic visions and, you know, these like psychedelic telling the future, anything like that. You know, Moses, the content of Moses' prophecy, the person who is described to us in the Torah at speaking face to face with God, the content of Moses' prophecy is none of these things. I'm sorry I keep jumping back and forth, but because these are like one-liners, I could go back to seeing you, and I really appreciate, you know, you guys being brave and having your cameras on. That's really amazing. I feel like I'm talking to somebody. The content of the greatest prophet, the content of his prophecy was like pay your workers on time, was like love your neighbor as thyself, right? Think about other people before yourself, was leave over a corner of your field for the poor and indigent, was bring this sacrifice to God in this specific way, don't deviate, right? The greatest of all prophets, the person who had the greatest understanding and connection to God, gave us things very, very clear, very, very, you know, you would say in Hebrew, chad v'chalak, sharp, you know, cut and dry. And it's sometimes a little bit complicated. There's a lot of laws around it, but it's fairly simple. It's super clear, right? It's instructions. That's the content of Moses' prophecy. Now, to be sure, there are moments where Moses goes into these paroxysms of poetry, and you know, we get this incredible stuff. We have Az Yashir, the song at the sea, arguably a collective prophecy. We have Shirat HaAzinu at the end of Torah, where Moses gives, you know, this cryptic veiled reference to all of history. Moses does go to these places, but the vast majority of Moses' prophecy is like, look, Hashem, I have like five young women that want to know if they get a portion of the land of Israel. Can you help me out here and tell me what the halacha is? That's the content of the greatest prophet's prophecy. As prophecy progresses, as the history of prophecy moves on, so the further away prophets get from Moses, the more complicated their prophecies get, up until you get to the later prophets, and it's cloaked in metaphor and mystery and opaque language, difficult language. The content of their prophecy becomes a little bit more difficult for us to understand. The Ramchal, great Jewish Kabbalist, philosopher, thinker, playwright, Musarist, wrote the book Mesilat Yesharim. I also happen to be a descendant of him, which is a separate discussion. I have a bunch of shirim if you want to learn more about the Ramchal. But the Ramchal writes in his book Derech Hashem, which is an exposition of a lot of these principles of faith. The Ramchal says that Moses' prophecy is likened to a person seeing another person through clear glass. As prophecy moves on towards the later prophets, with less of this direct, unmediated connection, it becomes almost like seeing God through like glass bricks, right? That you know something's on the other side. You can almost make out the form of what's on the other side, but it's hidden. It's obscured a little bit, and it's cloaked in mashal. It's cloaked in metaphor and difficult language. So that's how the qualitative difference between Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses' prophecy, and all the other prophets. Number eight is that the Torah is divine. Moses' Torah, the Torah that Moses gave to us, that was given by God to Moses to give to us at Har Sinai, every word of that Torah is absolutely divine. This is the concept of Torah min HaShamayim. The Torah is the direct record of revelation of God to us. That means, the Rambam says, that there is no difference between the psukim, the verses that talk about genealogy, seemingly boring verses, you know, just going through who begat who. There's no difference between those verses in the Torah and the verse Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear, O Israel, or what we consider to be, you know, the greatest of all psukim. They're all divine. Every word, every detail, every redundancy, every seeming grammatical change or quirk, all of that is meant to communicate something to us. And anybody that denies that this is true, that's somebody that's denying this principle of faith. This, I might say, is one of the super controversial, controversial in the sense that this aroused tons and tons of debate. One of the hardest ones to hold on fast to, especially with the rise of the academic study of Bible. Higher criticism and lower criticism of the Torah, the belief that the Torah is indeed a pastiche of documents, the documentary hypothesis you might be familiar with, that the Torah is a pastiche of documents that fall under roughly four rubrics of authors, I think is the way where the theory stands now, J, E, P, and D. Won't really have time to talk about this right now, or that the Torah is completely a human document, probably of the Second Temple period or even later than that, which is a record of victors. All of these ideas, all these conjectures amount to pure kfira, heresy, denial of this principle. And also, I think once the eighth principle falls apart, all the other principles fall apart. So smack there in the middle, Moshe and the Torah are two pillars upon which all the other principles fall apart, fall upon. And this is a really difficult one. There is a lot of great literature, some of it in the realm of apologetics, some of it a little bit more sophisticated, to talk about the divine origins of the Torah. How do we grapple with certain complicated, difficult verses in the Torah? But the eighth principle is the absolute divinity of the Torah, that it has never, that has never been changed and never will change. That's the eighth principle. Number nine, I feel like David Letterman over here. Number nine the Torah doesn't change. This is, Maimonides makes reference to a specific commandment here, which is really two commandments. You cannot add a mitzvah to the 600, you cannot add a commandment to the 613 commandments of the Torah. You cannot take away a commandment from the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. What was given to us, cannot be changed. Now, if you're keen, you might hear that Maimonides is also militating against those who might say that the covenant that was made, or the testament that we have, namely the Tanakh, is an old one, and that there is a new testament, that God replaces the covenant, that God supersedes the covenant he made with the Jewish people, or God appoints other prophets, later prophets, whose revelation, whether it's in a cave in the Arabian desert, or whether it's on the road to Damascus, there are other prophets who have greater revelations that supersede the revelation of Moses, and therefore they could say things like, there is a new Torah, or a new testament, or that the Torah's mitzvot are not binding, as Moses commands us. The Torah is divine, and it also doesn't change. That's really important. Think God's covenant to us through the Torah cannot be changed. Number 10 is Hashem knows and guides everything. This is the concept of Hashgacha Pratit. Now, there are various different levels of understanding this, right? Maimonides formulates in one place that there's only intimate divine guiding and caring for what we're doing for the righteous. For everybody else, you know, it's essentially, you know, put the system in place, type in a few commands, and you go according to your programming, more or less. Our accepted way of living, right, the way that we function, I think the vast majority of people, is that God is intimately concerned with every thought, every act, every word, everything that we do. Everything that we do, God, in his infinity, is concerned with us as if we were the only people on earth. That's this notion of like, Bishvili Nivrala Olam, the world was created for me. And in the other pocket, I'm but dust and ashes. God cares about what we do. All events in the world are orchestrated and dictated by God and God's master plan. In a word or two, right, God runs the world. That is Hashgacha Prati. There's a notion of Hashgacha Klalit, that God sets various natural processes in order, allows the world in a certain way to act according to the way that those certain events lead to other events, cause and effect. But the way I think that I live my life is that God is intimately aware and involved with every thought and everything that I do. That's Hashgacha Pratit. That's minuscule, minute concern for the details of my life and who I am as an individual person, as a piece of God that I contain in my soul. That's Hashgacha Pratit, that God controls the world. Now, if that's true, so then we find our way to number 11. If God is indeed intimately concerned with what I do, then we know that there is a concept of schar va'onesh, reward and punishment, which is that we are rewarded and punished for our actions. Our actions have consequences. We do good deeds, those good deeds engender more good deeds, and they find reward both in this world and in the world to come. And if we conversely do negative things, so there is a din, and there's a judge, and there's judgment. One of the scariest phrases in the Talmud are people that go to Tarbut Ra'ah, people who, you know, go off the path or deny the existence of God. And the phrase for people who were going off into that path is the declaration, late din, v'late dayan, there is no God, there is no judge, and there is no judgment. As if to say it's hefker, right? There's nobody in charge. Whatever we do, it's this Dionysian, do whatever you want. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. No, there is reward and punishment for our actions. We affirm that. Number 12 is that we wait for the Messiah. We wait one day to this broken world. There will be a Messiah. There will be a Redeemer. This one, I have to say to you, to me, is it might be more difficult to fully, truly believe than any of the other ones. And that includes number 13, that with the advent of that Messiah, we'll have the resurrection of the dead. It's hard to believe when you're stuck in a situation, when you're stuck in a world that is broken and shattered, and, you know, that we get, the news seems to get more distressing. I mean, what could be worse than the news we received 52 days ago now? But it seems to be that this belief has been the belief that sustains the Jewish people for all of our history. The belief that allows us to have all the other beliefs. That there is a Redeemer. And that Redeemer, right, there's been plenty of people who've come along in history and said, I am that Redeemer, or you are redeemed, right? You know, and here is thy kingdom come. And the Jewish people have always said, you know, not yet, this isn't it. Or the very scary turn of phrase, I think it was Professor Yeshayahu Leibowitz said, the Messiah that comes isn't, which is a terrifying thing to really think about. Right? We believe with full faith, animamim be'emuna shalema v'vias ha-mashiach. I believe with full, absolute faith that there will be a Messiah, that Messiah will come. And if that Messiah tarries, is I think the English word, if it tarries, we have patience. The Jewish people have epic, miraculous patience for our redemption. And we believe also that, we say in prayers, many synagogues, that the founding of the State of Israel, the return of people to their land, the revival of a nation and a language after millennia of wandering and of persecution, that itself is the clearest indication that miracles do happen. God still acts in history, that you have to just be attuned and open to see it, and that prophecies do come true. Right? Young and old play in the streets of Jerusalem. And even though we're not there yet, so we say in the prayer for the State of Israel that it is Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. That it is a process. There are some who believe that the State of Israel has absolutely no role in human hands being part of the redemptive process and therefore are opposed to the State of Israel on religious grounds. A share for another time, we can talk about where does that ideology come from. Right? But that we believe that there will be a Messiah. I'm reminded, I've told you guys the story of my grandfather that I heard after he died, that my grandfather just said to you, very, very short, it's a much longer story, but they, you know, they said in the camps, they were sure an angel that God would send his Messiah to come and to save them. And, you know, maybe I'll say the story. We'll finish off the story. My grandfather, I don't know if I've told you guys this. My grandfather told my father, was dancing with my grandfather in a Simchas Torah in Denver, Colorado. And I think he asked him, he said, you know, what was Sukkot like in the camps? And my grandfather said, he was, you know, an older teenager. He said that in Auschwitz, he recognized there was a rabbi, a dayan from one of the communities in Hungary. And he told him to come that, you know, another day, Nachtag, it's going to be Sukkot. And that they've figured a spot where they could go and take a piece of their rations and go into a hovel and make the brach of Leishev Masukkah. And my Saba went and he was there and they managed to sneak. I think it was behind one of the barracks for the camp guards, you know, right under their nose where they least expect it. And he goes into it and there's two Jews. He's there with this dayan from Hungary, this esteemed religious judge. And they're in this hovel and they make a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, you know, Shekhi Shalom Tzav Tzvan, Leishev Asukar, and Shachianu. And then they make a bracha on their black bread. And my Saba told my father, he said that he was certain at that moment, with their Mesirat Nefesh, with their self-sacrifice to perform this commandment of God in hell, that at that moment the sky would open up and the Messiah would come down, right into Auschwitz, everything would dissipate. And my dad said to my Saba, well, you know, Messiah didn't come. What did you do next? And my Saba said, well, the next thing that we did is we picked up and we decided to start saving our potatoes in order to be able to squeeze the oil out to make Hanukkah candles. So that's the Jew. That's what we do. That's what we do. That's our faith in the final thing. And I'll end off by saying a chidush, a novel idea that I had when I was going through this progress. I'm just going to share the screen. What I think the Rambam is describing over here in these 13 principles is not just 13 discrete things that we need to believe in and that they're all the same, but I see from number 1 to number 2 to number 3, all the way down to 13, it's a progression. We start with belief in the most abstract, difficult to understand, rarefied concepts. There's a creator. What does that even mean? Right? What came before this? What came before all of this? What was before this? Right? The mind struggles to comprehend it. And then the complete unity of God, and we go down and we start to get essentially down, basically excluding number 12 and 13, which are somewhere outside of the realm of all these other things. They stand on their own, that the dead shall live again and that we wait for the Messiah. We come all the way down from belief in these super abstract concepts to these concrete concepts of reward and punishment for our own actions. And each one follows from the other. And I think that's telling us a story. We start with belief in the most abstract things, belief in God. We end up in belief in ourselves. We end up in belief in our own actions, and the consequence of our own actions, and the importance of the things that we do. And once we believe in the importance of the things we do, that there is a din, and a dayan, and a judge, and a judgment, and then our actions matter, and then we get rewarded for them. and that we get punished for them, that they carry, that they're consequential, then and only then are we able to work our way back up the ladder to say, okay, you know, from belief in myself, now I'm able to believe in God, which is a line that comes from Rav Tzadok HaKohen, another beautiful, amazing thinker that I love, who says, "Kodem kol tzarech adam lahamin ba'atzma." Before anything else, a person must believe in themselves. I think maybe that comes from the same reading of this. Before belief in anything else, I have belief in myself. That's our second class. Just by a show of hands, should we continue? Because I'll just show you what I did. I prepared a lot more. I didn't think to extemporize.